Kate walked into the sitting room of the Riley-named Ambassador Suite in the Jaredar Arms, where she and, until tonight, Utina had laid claim to one bedroom while Dorothy and Jury claimed the other, her shoes still dangling from one hand, and was surprised to see Jury sitting there in one of the leather armchairs, reading a book. At the sound of Caitlin's entrance, the redhead put up the book, smiled, and rose to greet her.
I thought you'd be in bed, Kate said softly, not wanting to disturb Dorothy, who she expected was also asleep.
She sat down on the couch. Jury went to the other end and sat as well.
I've been thinking too much, she said. I thought about trying to find you, but there was no telling where you might have gone.
I went for a walk around the lake. It was beautiful, Kate said. Next time, come with me?
Jury smiled. Certainly. Did you have a good walk?
It was interesting. I seem to have acquired a disciple.
At Jury's cocked eyebrow, she recounted the story of her encounter with Sionji. Jury took it in with a very thoughtful expression, and when Kate was through, she mused,
There was a time when I would have had grave reservations about such a thing, but...
She smiled slightly, shaking her head in wonder.
Once I tried to deny the existence of miracles, and since Tenjo brought me to your world, I've been up to my eyebrows in them. Sometimes I wonder if I'm going mad, she added wryly.
You'll get used to it, Kate replied with an impish grin.
I hope so, Jury replied. Then she observed, You're going to be a very busy girl, with a student on top of everything else you have to do.
Never too busy for you, I hope. Said Kate, a little shyly.
Slowly, as if she were not quite sure whether she should, Jury reached across the couch and took hold of Caitlin's hand.
I hope so, too, she said softly.
Kate smiled, squeezed the redhead's hand, and the two of them sat there like that for a few minutes in a calm, warm silence. Then, a little awkwardly, Kate stifled a yawn. To show that she understood, Jury said in a tone of slightly exaggerated briskness,
I'm glad tomorrow is Sunday. After tonight, I can use the day off.
Kate grinned a little in relief, and the two women stood up. Jury switched off the standing lamp she'd been reading by, leaving the room illuminated only by the light of Bajor through the French doors, and the nightlights over the bedroom doors. For a moment, they faced each other in the darkness. Kate was still holding her shoes in her free hand.
Well, good night, Caitlin, said Jury after a few seconds.
Jury, said Kate softly.
Hmm? Jury responded.
I'm not ready,
Kate said slowly, now stammering as well as stuttering in the great awkwardness of the moment.
Jury looked at her in the planet light for a few moments more, then smiled and stepped nearer.
I understand, she said.
She reached out one long, slim hand and cupped the side of Kate's face, leaned nearer still, and smilingly murmured,
Take as long as you need, Caitlin. I'll be here.
Then, very gently, she leaned even nearer and kissed the shorter girl's lips. Kate's shoes hit the carpeted floor with a soft thud.
Good night, Caitlin, repeated Jury softly.
Good night, Jury, replied Kate,
and, slowly, they went their separate ways. 2 days later, on the concourse of Babylon 5, Caitlin bade a very different farewell to another tall, cool, elegant girl she'd known far longer, and, in some peculiar ways, knew far better.
"Well, Liza," she said, I'm glad you're doing this."
Liza Broadbent cracked a wry smile and said, "Going far, far away from you? Yeah, I bet you've wanted that for quite some years now." Kate went a little pink and said,
That's not what I meant.
"I know," said Liza, her smile softening somewhat. She hit Kate gently on the shoulder. "I just couldn't resist pulling your tail a little. Old habits die hard, you know," she added with a wink. "Anyway, take care of yourself, Caitlin, and have no fear. I'll be back in September to terrorize you and your little friends with the stories of my exploits among the stars. They'll all be so envious of me and my adventures that they'll just die." The blonde put her hands on her hips, threw back her head, and let out a big, rolling, "Oh-ho-ho-ho-ho-ho!" laugh that set Kate's teeth on edge.
"Please, don't laugh like that," she whimpered.
Liza stopped as if someone had thrown a switch, looked thoughtful, and then said, as if she'd just realized it,
"You know, I hate it when people laugh like that, too. My mother laughs like that. It's the most annoying thing in the world."
She shook her head, chuckling at herself.
"The things you start noticing when your mind snaps."
Off to the side, Sionji nodded gravely, causing Liza to shoot him a sly little grin. The PA system bonged and made an announcement in a language Kate didn't understand, but recognized, and Skaya perked up a little. "Final boarding call, Elizabeth," he said briskly, hefting her duffel bag and handing it to her. "Off you go. It wouldn't do to keep Captain Ariane waiting on your very first day. Good luck. Keep your tail out of the mud."
Sionji nodded again, less gravely this time. "Indeed. Good luck, Liza, and take care. We'll see you in the fall."
Liza nodded in return.
"Thank you, Sky, Sionji. Thank you for everything. I wouldn't be on this path if not for both of you.
I won't forget that. Or you either, Kate, in your way," she added, grinning.
"I feel like I should give you a goodbye hug, except you'd probably snap my spine just out of reflex."
Kate, with smiling exasperation, brushed that silly notion aside with a gesture of her hands and embraced her erstwhile nemesis.
"Good luck, Liza," she said. I mean that. I'll see you when you get back.
"I'll send you all a postcard from the Crab Nebula," Liza promised airily. Then she shouldered her bag and trotted off to the boarding gate, singing "See You in September" somewhat painfully off-key. Kate watched her go until the gate had closed behind her and the Scrang trading ship had undocked and pulled away. Then the three duelists went to one of the monitors to watch it enter the metagate and vanish.
"That," Kate mused, "was a surreal experience. Not bad surreal, just surreal."
"I hope she finds what she's looking for out there," said Sionji.
"She will," Skaya said positively. "We Scrang have a saying."
"Of course you do," Sionji murmured with a dry little smile.
Skye paid the interruption no heed at all and went on grandly, "All things of value can be found somewhere along the river. Of course, the river is rather more of a metaphor nowadays than it was when the saying was coined, but you get the idea."
Kate nodded. I hope so, she said.
"Well, come on, Kyuichi-kun.
Let's go see Dad about your application.
Success, Mr. Sionji, said Skaya with a formal bow. I'll see the two of you back on the surface this evening.
Sunday, June 6th, 2405, 11:07 a.m., Alan Turing Institute for the Study of Cybernetic Life, Turing 3, Niven Sector. R. Dorothy Wainwright was not a person given to anxiety. Though more emotional than she had been only 6 months ago, she was nonetheless of a mainly phlegmatic disposition, and that was not inclined to change just because she had found such wonders in the world as friendship, warmth, loyalty, and passion. She did not fidget. She did not pace. She did not worry at buttons, or chew her fingernails, or glance compulsively at clocks. Having been her roommate since February, Juri Arisugawa certainly knew all this. It was a prime factor in their successful partnership as roommates, since Juri was a person easily annoyed by neurotic habits. Having lived alone for several years, she required a certain measure of quiet and serenity in her surroundings. As such, she found it quite telling that, as she sat on the bench in the corridor outside Hearing Room 17, R. Dorothy kept tapping her right index finger against her knee. Today, though, Juri didn't grudge her friend that one little gesture of nervousness. After all, the board impaneled in that room was only going to decide whether or not Dorothy was a sentient life form today. Dorothy noticed her roommate looking at her, turned her head, and said, "You might as well go to lunch." Juri smiled her little Vulcan smile and replied, "That's all right. I think I'd rather stay here. Besides, Caitlin will bring me back something to eat."
"As you wish," Dorothy replied, and turned her eyes back to the doors.
Juri didn't take offense. Dorothy's tendency toward curtness was a matter of efficiency more than rudeness, and besides, she was on edge today. She wouldn't be tapping that finger otherwise. Dorothy had no need to glance at the clock on the wall near the elevator, or to wear and consult a wristwatch. She always knew exactly what time it was. Part of her sensory apparatus was a small subetheric transceiver, which synchronized her onboard time sense to the galactic standard atomic time signal. She knew exactly when it was 11:10, then 11:15, then 11:20. At 11:22 and 17.093 seconds, the rest of the Duelist Society returned from lunch, and, true to Juri's prediction, Kate had brought her a hamburger, a packet of fries, and a cherry Coke from the Johnny Rockets in the Institute's food court. Moose McEachern was with them, having arrived from Hoffman half an hour earlier. He greeted Dorothy and Juri with a big smile, and on Moose, a big smile was a big smile, and informed them that his family was very well, thank you. So too were Jacron, freshly arrived from Narn, and Mac McKenzie, crisply formal in his freespacer dress uniform. They chatted for a few minutes, catching up on the latest from Mac's job with the contractor performing the fleet refit, and Jacron's time with his family. Mac didn't say much. Most of his energies were being channeled straight into pulling himself together from the warp-speed journey to Turing 3, so that he wouldn't look shocky and twitchy for the board. Presently, an opening in the conversation appeared, and into it, Juri inserted the question Dorothy wouldn't allow herself to ask.
"Any sign of the others?"
"Corwin and Utna are..."
Kate took her pocket watch from the obi of the Kenjutsu-inspired formal garb Juri had bought for her on Babylon 5, consulted it, and tucked it away again.
20 minutes out in metaspace. Congestion at the Tomodachi Gate. They'll be here."
"No word on Miki and Azalin, though," said Wakaba Shinohara glumly. "There aren't regularly scheduled flights from Dantrov to, well, anywhere, so there's no telling how they're getting here."
She sighed.
"I hope they're all right," said Sionji. Suddenly, there was someone on his back, slim, coppery arms encircling his neck, matching legs about his waist,
and something sharp nipped at his earlobe before a familiar voice told him, "Oh, we're just fine."
Sionji staggered, putting his hand against the marble wall to keep from falling into Juri's lap. Azalin Devir Natashkin alighted from his back like an heiress getting off the boat train from Southampton, pirouetted, and asked the assembled group, "Did you miss me?" There were pleased greetings all around, and Caitlin, for one, noticed that Azalin certainly did look better than she had when she'd left Babylon 5 for Dantrov, the day after the founding of Mandeville Memorial had been announced. Then she had been unusually subdued, almost frightened, suffering from an imbalance of emotion she attributed to too long away from her homeworld and other Dantrovians. Now she was, by all appearances, her own self again, bright-eyed, sprightly, and flirtatious, her smile as broad and as bright as it could be. Like all of them, she was dressed formally, in the scarlet two-piece bodysuit and voluminous, airy, sari-slash-toga hybrid wrap she'd worn to the WPI spring formal. A bit behind her, standing with a backpack slung on one shoulder and a fond little smile on his face, stood Miki Kaworu. And if the change in Azalin was dramatic, in Miki it was almost shocking. He was dressed in a relaxed-looking, slightly crumpled summer suit of cream-colored linen, a white shirt, and a yellow-striped tie, brown and cream saddle shoes and a Panama hat. The very picture of a young gentleman on holiday in sunny Cairo, or perhaps the Caribbean. He even had a frilled sun umbrella, which he was holding like a cane. The pale cream color of his clothes threw his suntan into sharp contrast. He was almost as coppery as Azalin, and she looked that way, rain or shine. It looked a bit odd against his bright blue hair and made his cobalt eyes look paler than they really were. Wakaba turned and goggled at him. Truth be told, all of them goggled at him a bit. Sionji leaned against the wall next to Juri's bench with his arms folded, smiled with mild sardony, and said, "Been getting a bit of sun, Kaworu? I thought spring on Dantrov didn't start until next month." Miki grinned. "Azalin's family took an equatorial holiday this year."
"Without telling me where they were going, thank you very much," said Azalin indignantly. "Took us 3 days to find them. We almost missed the festival of the fudge sauce."
"The festival of... Okay, no, I don't want to know," said Wakaba, shaking her head.
"Are you sure?" asked Azalin. "It's a really interesting story."
Wakaba nodded.
"I'm sure. Thanks anyway."
Azalin shrugged.
"Suit yourself."
Then she focused on the girl of the hour and asked, "So, Dorothy, how do you think things are going so far?"
Dorothy looked thoughtful, then replied, "The board are difficult to read, by design, I'm sure, but the practical tests have gone well, and I'm confident that I've passed the physical and intellectual challenges. In the end, though, I believe it will all come down to the character assessment."
She smiled very slightly.
"I'm grateful that you were able to make it."
"We wouldn't miss it," said Miki. He stepped around the Dantrovian, smiled, and then hesitated. Dorothy got to her feet and hesitated in turn, and then the two embraced.
"I wouldn't miss it," he added, in a softer voice as he hugged her. "I've missed you, Dorothy."
"I've..." She took a half step back, their hands still on each other's shoulders, and a hint of color came into the bridge of her nose.
"I've missed you, too," she replied softly.
Then she looked over his shoulder at Azalin and inquired with a slightly impish smile,
"Was he helpful?"
"Very," Azalin replied, without a trace of jest.
"I don't know what I would have done without him. Thank you."
Dorothy took that in, considered it, and then nodded in her understated way. Skaya, the Duelist Society's resident Skrang, checked his own watch and tisked.
"I hope Miss Tenjo and Corwin don't meet with any further unexpected delays.
As it is, given time for landing and arranging ground transportation to the Institute..." As though summoned by the Skrang's concerns, two figures materialized in the corridor amid the blue-white wash of a Utopia Planitia matter transporter.
Utena Tenjo, in the full dress uniform she was entitled to wear by virtue of her International Police Organization Space Force Reserve Commission, and Corwin Ravenhair, in the sharpest-looking double-breasted black suit ever. "Or not," said Skaia, bemused. Then he swept his tri-cornered hat from his pointy pteranodon head and bowed formally to them. "Greetings, wanderers," he said. "I trust your travels go smoothly so far."
"So far, so good," said Utena with a grin. She took a moment to embrace her roommate, admired Mickey's suit and his tan for a second, then turned to Dorothy, hugged her too, and said, "Sorry we were almost late. Freighter accident at the Tomodachi Gate."
"Oh dear," said Mia. "I hope no one was hurt."
"Nah, just some bozo fat-fingering his helm and jackknifing a Super Clydesdale in the approach lane," said Corwin. "He didn't lose hull integrity or anything, but he wrecked his impulse reactor and had to be towed out. Time it was all said and done, it almost would have been faster to hyperspace to New Hokkaido and use their gate."
He shrugged. "But we're here now." He grinned and angled a thumb at Utena. "And my student here got a valuable object lesson in why it pays to stay focused when you're piloting into a gate."
Utena grinned back and retorted, "Somehow I doubt I'll ever be flying anything the size of a Super Clyde, Professor Ravenhair."
"You never know," Corwin replied. Then he stood for a moment, taking in the sight of Dorothy in her best dress, the scarlet and red gown his Aunt Beldandy had made for her. She'd added her broad-brimmed round hat and put on just a touch of makeup. He thought the overall look suited her very well, and told her so, after giving her a hug. It was just as he was stepping back and preparing to say something encouraging that the door to the hearing room opened, and the uniformed functionary informed them all that the board had reconvened and would hear character references now. Utena tugged her uniform jacket smooth and adjusted the chain that hung from her rank bar to her star badge, then patted Dorothy encouragingly on the shoulder, and they all entered the chamber together. R. Dorothy sat bolt upright in the petitioner's box, which rather resembled, in position and appearance, the prisoner's dock in old English courtrooms, and watched with outward calm as a parade of people took the witness stand one by one and declared themselves her friends before the five beings who, in this case, constituted the Turing board. A small blue Autobot she didn't recognize, two humans, an elderly Seleucian woman, and the ever-shifting blob of a Dralocyte. Of course, they were doing more than that. They were answering specific questions and giving specific examples of Dorothy's capacities for friendship, loyalty, compassion, and negative emotions too, anger, annoyance, vengefulness. It all went into the evaluation. As the Dralocyte, Bordag Gelp, had informed her at the outset of the evaluation on Friday afternoon, "It's not really important to us whether you're a good person, although it probably won't hurt if you are." As with Horta, it was often difficult to tell when Dralocytes were choking. Corwin spoke at length, describing the circumstances under which he had come to own Dorothy, her history before that point as best he knew it, and her time with him since then. He left no doubt in any observer's mind that he believed totally in his possession's right to be free of him, a relatively rare position for owners to take, even if they did have to sponsor their robots' petitions for emancipation to get this far in the first place. Very carefully, he restrained himself from soapboxing about cybernetic rights reform. This wasn't the place, and he didn't want to do anything that might prejudice the board against him and, by association, Dorothy. Caitlin, who knew better than most his disdain for the present system, under which, as he had once put it, people like Dorothy had to scrape and do tricks to claim their natural sentience rights, was proud of him for that self-restraint. So too was Utena, who had heard many of the same restrained rants during the quiet bits of their many times together. Dorothy evinced little visible reaction, but those who knew her could tell she was relieved as well. As he quit the stand, such a polite young man, image intact, he threw her a subtle wink, to which she responded with a vestigial smile. The next person to speak was, coincidentally, Corwin's mother,
The renowned roboticist Dr. Skuld Ravenhair of the Nakomi Institute of Technology on Tomodachi. She addressed the board members as a colleague, explaining to them various technical details of Dorothy's construction, and then digressed into a more personal assessment which was, in every respect, glowing. Like Corwin, she refrained from preaching about the sad state of machine life rights in the galaxy. One by one they spoke, including several whose presence surprised Dorothy considerably. Professor Ravi Chandrajan, late of the WPI Literature Department, and soon to occupy a similar position on the faculty of the Mandeville Memorial Institute, bubbled over with eager testimony as to Dorothy's keen intellect, inquisitive spirit, and insightful fondness for the subject he taught. Professor Krog, the WPI and now DSM Duelist Society's faculty advisor, took the stand in his Klingon battle finery and insisted that she was a creature of great honor. Julian Bashir, the chief medical officer of Babylon 5 and Dorothy's unofficial vet, grinningly informed the board that Dorothy Wainwright was a person thoroughly committed to the proper care of her pet cat, Peril. The vessel which had brought those three men and most of the duelists to Turing III was the command of Corwin's father, IPO Space Force Captain Benjamin Hutchins, known to all as Griffin. Since Dorothy had lived under his roof during her time with Corwin, well under it, since she'd spent most of her time in Corwin's underground workshop complex, but still, Griffin took the stand himself. So did his executive officer, Lor Soong, himself a Turing-certified mechano-humanoid. He explained that Dorothy's construction was an evolution of his own, her creator having been Dr. Timothy Wainwright, the protégé of his own creator, the famed roboticist Noonien Soong. That seemed to leave quite an impression on three of the board members, though the old Seleucian and Gelp didn't seem very moved by it. The sheer number of her supporters shocked Dorothy as she watched them cross the witness stand. She'd never thought before about just how many would be here today, never stopped to count them up in her mind. Here was Jury describing their rooming arrangement at WPI, every bit of her cool self-possession marshaled to impress upon the board that she knew exactly what she was talking about when she described Dorothy as her friend. Here was Azalin imparting the act of great compassion Dorothy had performed and allowing Miki to accompany her to Dantrov when, by rights, he probably should have been helping Dorothy prepare for this evaluation. Here was Miki. Miki in his cream-colored suit and yellow tie, combed, clean-cut, eminently presentable, telling the board that he and Dorothy were lovers, without a trace of embarrassment or shame on his boyishly handsome face. The revelation caused a bit of a stir in the gallery, and a bit of a stir in the board, come to that. The old, white-haired, gray-furred Seleucian seemed tickled pink by it. The Dralocyte formed himself into a cube of not-displeased astonishment. The Autobot didn't seem to understand what the big deal was, and the two humans were scandalized. Typical, thought Corbin as he fought not to smirk in the front row. Dr. Emmett Taylor, one of the two humans, began a vigorous cross-examination on this point. Miki, drawing on all the open unshockability his time on Dantrov had given him, remained resolutely unembarrassed, but quite firmly put a stop to it when he felt that the level of detail was becoming needlessly granular. Dorothy sat in the petitioner's box with a smile and a furious blush competing for real estate on her face, a most unusual expression for her, and one which all her friends took time out to savor. Once that was settled, and the bridge of Dorothy's nose stopped burning, Sionchi came to the stand and told them that he'd taught Dorothy some meditation techniques based on his kendo studies, and that she'd taken to them very well. He remarked that, in his opinion, she would make an excellent martial artist, if she ever found the inclination to take up such a course of study. Before such a large, varied group of total strangers, Caitlin took a long, painful time to make her agreement with Sionji and other salient points understood. But she stuck gamely to it, soldiering on, after being rather stuffily denied permission to sing her testimony by Dr. Taylor, and generally taking the attitude that, if the board wouldn't let her address them in a manner that was easy for her, then they didn't get to hear her testimony in a manner that was easy for them, either. The afternoon went on, and still they came. Wakaba said she didn't know Dorothy well, having met her the most recently of any of her fellow students, but there had never been any doubt in her mind that her old schoolmate Jury's auburn-haired roommate was a real person. Mac concurred with this and said he had enjoyed having her as a roommate until she'd been forced out of Galaxy House through the petty maneuvering of a faculty member he preferred not to name. Jacron had no such compunctions, and blustered quite effectively about the narrow-minded bigotry of Professor Aaron Harris, adding that he trusted none of the board were of such limited mentality. But then, if they were, he said with a confident, "We're all cleverer than that" smile, why would they be here? It was a bravura performance by the young Narn, and his friends smiled and told themselves that he had a bright future in his homeworld diplomatic corps some day. A courier delivered a notarized deposition from Edward Tversky and Ein, current whereabouts unknown, which went into excruciatingly technical detail as to just why Dorothy's positronic personality matrix had to be considered a sentience, then added that Ein liked her, which was, according to Edward, as good for purposes of arbitration as the unfiltered word of God. A visibly amused Moose McEachern kept it short, simple, and along those same lines. He didn't have much patience for AI systems and robots. He liked Dorothy, quod erat demonstrandum. Mia concurred with Moose's assessment, mentioning the Minbari reverence for life in all its forms, and indicating that there was no doubt in her Minbari-trained heart that Dorothy was worthy of that reverence. Janice Barlow, crisp and fresh in an IPO trainee's uniform, tested that she'd been Dorothy's resident advisor for 2 terms at WPI and had had no trouble whatsoever with her. A Corellian-descended colonist of the Rimworld Ragal, she was familiar with simple droids, and she could and did wryly assure the board that Dorothy was no simple droid. After her, Skaya explained the Barsavian concept of sentience as name-givers, pointing to the example of Peril, and then went on at some length with a rather elliptical but interesting discourse on the 4 Skrangish pillars of a name-giver's worth in life and our Dorothy's admirable standing with all of them. At 4:30, when all the duelists and their friends had spoken except for Utina, and she was just preparing to take the stand, the doors at the back of the room opened. To the surprise of almost everyone in the hearing room, in marched a dozen armed Romulans, dressed, incongruously, in the uniform of the Gamelon Imperial Guards. This honor guard, led by a short and well-built Gamelon redhead, flanked the dress-uniformed regal presence of Princess Amanda Electra Dessler and the grinning, blonde-shocked figure of Devlin Carter, who waved gaily to the startled girl in the petitions box. "I am Dessler of the Lorica," said Amanda, her imperial voice in full plumage. "I apologize for disrupting these proceedings, but we were delayed in transit and we must speak." Dr. Taylor, who seemed to be the resident fuss budget on this particular board, sputtered a bit, but old Dr. Squirrel told him to stuff a sock in it and bade the Princess of Gamelon say her piece. This she did, describing Dorothy's loyalty to the Duelist Society and praising her heroism in the Society's battle against the forces of the Psi-Corps, which had sacked their school and nearly killed several of them in their zeal to capture Devlin Carter. The board were quite aware of this incident, of course. While trying to twist events to their own purposes, the Corps had spuriously filed to rescind Dorothy's application for evaluation, a shenanigan of which the board took a very dim view. Then Devlin said his piece, describing his own friendship with Dorothy, their confrontation with Professor Harris at WPI, and their subsequent transfer to Professor Chandrigan's class. Upon hearing that the professor had already been heard from, he was delighted and said that in that case he had very little to add, but that he would be obliged if the board would let him point out, as Amanda had, what a good and true friend she'd been to them during the whole crisis. Finally, at 4:55, with certain members of the board looking rather tired and, well, bored, Utina Tenjo ascended to the stand and stated her name for the record. "My name is Utina Tenjo," she said, "and I guess you could say I'm the reason Dorothy is here today." She didn't raise her voice, but she spoke firmly, as she described Dorothy's transformation from withdrawn, self-dismissing doll to calm, self-possessed, poised young woman over the past two school terms, Utina recaptured the wandering attention of the board. By the time she finished, she had them all, even Dr. Taylor, nodding and jotting notes. Months ago, on the morning of my birthday, in fact, Dorothy and I had a conversation, she said. We talked about how intimidating it is to grow up and take responsibility for yourself, and the courage it takes to do that in a world where it sometimes seems as if everything is aligned to keep you from succeeding. You don't necessarily have to be a robot to feel that way, she told them, her eyes hardening. In some worlds, you only have to be a girl. Dorothy and I have both faced the same choice, Utina concluded, her chin held high. We've both chosen to climb out of the box and face the world on our own terms. If this board cannot see fit to recognize that choice and that courage, then, as I see it, it won't just have denied Dorothy her rightful place in the world. It will be denying that I'm a real person, or Caitlin, or anyone else who's had to make that choice and fight that fight. Humanity isn't about birth or construction. She touched her chest, her eyes defiant, and said, It's about spirit. And if Dorothy didn't have that, she wouldn't be here in the first place. Her piece said, Utina composed herself, gave a short bow, thanked the board for its time, and retired amid the impressed applause of the gallery. She went back to her seat, outwardly calm and inwardly feeling that familiar, fluttery, I said what to who? Sensation that she always got at moments like this. Taking her place next to Corwin, she glanced at her watch, and for just an instant, as the crystal face caught the overhead lights, she saw Dios grinning at her, his thumb raised in approval. Chuckling faintly, Utina sat back and waited for the board's decision. The five scientists conferred among themselves in field-muted silence for a few minutes, but it was impossible for those watching them to tell what direction their discussion was taking. It didn't seem to be an argument, only a fairly mild exchange, and they showed no signs of retiring to chambers. After a few tense minutes, they all nodded to each other, and Emmett Taylor stood up and clicked off the acoustic damping field.
"This board has reached its decision," he announced without preamble. "The petitioner will please rise."
Dorothy got to her feet, and in the gallery so did Utina and Corwin and Caitlin, and then all the rest of the duelists and their friends.
"Our Dorothy Wainwright," said Taylor, pretending not to notice the gallery. "It is the decision of this duly empaneled evaluation board, and thus of the Turing Institute, that you have met the qualifications and requirements for designation as a sentient life form, with all the rights and responsibilities thereunto ascribed by galactic law. Is there a representative of your home polity present?"
Griffin, standing up in the gallery with the rest, raised his hand and said with a dry smile, "I believe I can speak for the Republic of Zeta Cygni, Doctor."
"Just so," said Taylor with an uncomfortable smile. "Very well. Captain, do you concur with the decision of this board? Will the Republic of Zeta Cygni accept the petitioner as a fully qualified citizen?"
"Without reservation," Griffin replied flatly.
"Thank you, Captain. Mr. Ravenhair," said Taylor, turning his flat brown eyes to Corwin.
"Doctor," said Corwin, nodding.
"Do you accept this board's decision, acknowledge the petitioner's right of separation, and undertake not to bear her animus or seek reparation for damages incurred in the said separation?"
"Absolutely," Corwin replied.
"Very well. In that case, congratulations, Miss Wainwright. Your petition for designation as a free intelligence is approved."
Dorothy very properly and politely thanked Dr. Taylor and indeed all the board for their decision,
but there was no way for them to hear it over all the cheering.